Famine is imminent in Gaza.
100% of the population in Gaza is at severe levels of acute food insecurity. That's the first time an entire population has been so classified.
Plus, Hong Kong passes a sweeping and controversial new security law.
This law is very broad and too general, and a lot of gray area that a lot of people, they still need to think about it, because this is totally against the civil law, the traditional civil law.
And later, the Ukraine Defense Contact Group is underway in Germany, and conditions show no sign of improving in Haiti. Today is Tuesday, March 19th. And this is VOA's Flashpoint Global Crises. Good evening, I'm Steve Karish in Washington. On Tuesday, while in the Philippines, United States Secretary of State Antony Blinken discussed his upcoming trip to the Middle East, saying it has several goals.
So with regard to the trip that we'll be taking from here, going on to Saudi Arabia and to Egypt, the purpose is multifold. It's, of course, to push for an agreement on a ceasefire and the release of hostages. As you know, we're intensely engaged on that every single day, and we're doing everything we can to push that forward and to reach an agreement.
The visit will be to discuss the right architecture for lasting regional peace, Blinken said at a news conference with his Filipino counterpart, Enrique Manalo. It was conducted as part of an official visit to the Philippines. Blinken also said the U.S. has communicated to Israel the need to have a plan for Gaza following the war.
I can say we've also impressed upon Israel the imperative of having a plan for Gaza for when the conflict ends, which we hope will be as soon as possible, consistent with Israel's needs to defend itself and make sure that October 7th can never happen again.
Gaza is on the brink of famine, and this highlights another point at which the Netanyahu administration and the Biden administration are seeing things differently. John Alterman is with the Center for Strategic and International Studies.
The discussion in Israel is still about the threat that comes from Hamas, the sense that we have to make sure that October 7th never happens again. And I think a lingering sense that Palestinians are overwhelmingly supportive of Hamas, and therefore compassion won't get you a willingness to coexist. Compassion will mean that you're just helping people survive who will fight Israel in the future.
Israel's restrictions on humanitarian aid for Gaza may amount to a starvation tactic that could be a war crime, the United Nations human rights chief said on Tuesday. Jeremy Lawrence is spokesperson for the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights.
The projected imminent famine in Gaza can and must be prevented. The alarm bells sounded over the past months by the UN, including our office, have not been heeded. This catastrophe is human-made and was entirely preventable. The situation of hunger, starvation, and famine is a result of Israel's extensive restrictions on the entry and distribution of humanitarian aid and commercial goods, displacement of most of the population, as well as the destruction of crucial civilian infrastructure.
The stark appraisal followed a UN-backed report on Monday saying that famine is likely by May without an end to the fighting in the more than five-month war between Israel and Hamas militants in the Palestinian enclave of 2.3 million people. Famine is assessed by the Integrated Food Security Phase Classification, or IPC, an initiative of more than a dozen UN agencies, regional bodies, and aid groups. In a famine, food shortages are followed first by widespread malnutrition and then mass deaths. For the IPC to declare famine, at least 20% of the population must be suffering extreme food shortages, with one in three children acutely malnourished, and two out of every 10,000 people dying daily from starvation, malnutrition, and disease. Famine has been declared just twice in the past 13 years, in Somalia in 2011 and in South Sudan in 2017. But as one UN official noted, once a famine is declared, it is too late for too many people. Israel has said it will try to flood the Gaza Strip with humanitarian aid as global pressure mounts to tackle the growing problem of hunger, a problem that has gotten so bad the U.S. is even building a pier to deliver aid. Again, Secretary Blinken.
Again, according to the most respected measure of these things, 100% of the population in Gaza is at severe levels of acute food insecurity. That's the first time an entire population has been so classified. We also see, again, according to, in this case, the United Nations, 100%, the totality of the population, is in need of humanitarian assistance. Compare that to Sudan, about 80% of the population there is in need of humanitarian assistance. Afghanistan, about 70%. So, again, this only underscores both the urgency, the imperative of making this the priority.
With regards to the ceasefire negotiations in Doha, Majed al-Ansari, the Qatari Foreign Ministry spokesperson, reported that there is still no deal, though he is cautiously optimistic.
I don't think we are at a moment now where we can say that we are close to a deal. We are, as I said, we are cautiously optimistic because the talks have resumed, and that is a good thing, and we hope that that continues, and we hope to build upon that in the coming days. But it's still too early to announce any successes.
One of the largest disagreements on the issue of a ceasefire and between President Biden and Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu more broadly is the proposed invasion of Rafah. President Biden has repeatedly told Netanyahu to show restraint and to protect civilians. Netanyahu said on Tuesday that
we have an argument with the Americans about the need to enter Rafah, not about the need to eliminate Hamas, the need to enter Rafah. We see no way to eliminate Hamas militarily without destroying those remaining battalions. We are determined to do it.
Biden administration officials have warned they would not support an operation in Rafah without the Israelis presenting a credible plan to ensure the safety of innocent Palestinian civilians. At least 10 people were killed in a wealthy suburb of Haiti's capital on Monday. There were reports of looting and thefts of electricity equipment cut the power supply as lawlessness spread to affluent areas and gangs tightened their grip on the capital city. For more on the latest in Haiti, my colleague Scott Walterman spoke with Sandra Lemaire, chief of VOA's Creole service.
Bodies were found in a suburb of Port-au-Prince called Pétionville. This suburb is a wealthy suburb. And according to our reporter who went to the scene, there are 24 bodies found strewn about in the streets. Authorities say it was the gangs who killed these people. Our sources say that it's because they're on a rampage because a lot of the gang members of the G9 gang were killed.
It's unusual for this type of neighborhood, a wealthy upscale neighborhood, to be attacked, right?
Yes, it is. But the gangs have said that if they don't get what they want, which is they want a seat at the table of this transitional presidential council that CARICOM announced a plan for, that they will then just attack and continue going forward with their plan to take over the capital. So this is all part of their plan to make everyone take notice, you know, and basically terrorize citizens so that people don't go against what they want.
So basically, at this point, there's no government, right?
We can't say that there isn't a government. There is, but is it functioning? No. So basically, the finance minister is in charge. His last name is Boisvert. He is the interim prime minister. Prime Minister Henri has said that he will resign once the transitional council is in place, which has not yet happened. So Ariane Henri is actually in charge until that council takes power.
What are we looking at over the next couple of days?
It's really a crapshoot. We don't really know. The only thing we know for sure is things will probably get worse. There is Guy Philippe, a former senator from the South, the Grandons, who has joined ranks with the gangs, and the gangs support him, and they told him and say publicly that they want him to be recognized as the president. They want him to lead a three-person council, and they're talking about basically inaugurating him, rogue style, at some point this week. So the two plans for leadership are clashing with one another. And so it's left Haiti in a very volatile situation because, of course, if the gangs don't get their way, which the international community does not want them to have their way, then they've said they're just going to start killing people.
That's Sandra Lemaire, chief of VOA's Creole service, speaking with Scott Walterman, host of International Edition, right here on The Voice of America. The 20th meeting of the Ukraine Defense Contact Group was held in Germany on Tuesday. Meanwhile, U.S. Senator Lindsey Graham visited Kyiv on Monday. VOA correspondent Anna Chernikova has the details from Kyiv.
On March 19, the 20th meeting of the Ukraine Defense Contact Group was held in Germany. The Ministry of Defense of Ukraine reports that the priority at this meeting is negotiations on providing air defense systems and long-range missiles. Artillery projectiles, especially 155mm caliber, modern electronic warfare, and electronic signals intelligence systems, and armored vehicles remain constant discussion points. U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin, in his opening remarks, pledged that the United States would continue to support Ukraine's military efforts against Russia.
And ladies and gentlemen, let's not kid ourselves. Putin will not stop at Ukraine. But as President Biden has said, Ukraine can stop Putin if we stand with Ukraine and provide the weapons that it needs to defend itself. Ukraine's survival is on the line, and all of our security is on the line. So we will continue to stand together to resist Putin's campaign of conquests, and we will continue to keep the faith with the people of Ukraine.
Austin recalled that only last week the U.S. announced additional security support to Ukraine worth $300 million. Austin called the measure an emergency to support urgent needs for air defense, artillery, and anti-tank capabilities. Austin once again ensured Ukraine can rely on allies.
So our message today is clear. The United States will not let Ukraine fail. This coalition will not let Ukraine fail, and the free world will not let Ukraine fail.
U.S. Senator Lindsey Graham visited Kyiv on Monday, March 18th, to inform Ukrainian authorities and society of a new approach the U.S. is considering to give the Ukrainian aid package a go. Aid in the form of a loan or a lend-lease program. Graham stated,
"So I told the president, I'm all in for helping Ukraine, but we have to do it in a form of a loan. No interest, waivable if necessary, for all of our allies. This is going to be a new way of doing business. I think it will get more public support back home. When I go back home and talk about Israel, people understand. When I talk about Ukraine, they understand. But they also wonder about us, about our nation, about our ability to help ourselves as well as help our allies. So I think President Trump's idea of turning aid into a forgivable non-interest-bearing loan makes a lot of sense, and I'm hoping it will get out of the House, the package, in the coming days, not weeks. I talked to the Speaker before I came over here. He's trying to find a way to move Ukraine aid.
Graham pointed out he's in Ukraine's camp, but has to address the internal issues too, to avoid internal disputes. He also said he supports the idea of providing ATACMS missiles to Ukraine. Anna Chernikova, VOA News, Kyiv.
You're listening to Flashpoint Global Crises from the Voice of America. I'm Steve Karish in Washington. Hong Kong lawmakers unanimously passed a new national security law on Tuesday that grants the government more power to squash dissent. It's widely seen as the latest step in a sweeping political crackdown that was triggered by pro-democracy protests in 2019. The legislature passed the Safeguarding National Security Bill during a special session on Tuesday. It comes on top of a similar law imposed by Beijing 4 years ago, which has already largely silenced opposition voices. Hong Kong's Legislative Council, which is packed with Beijing loyalists following an electoral overhaul, expedited the process. I spoke with Raymond Yam. He's the service chief of VOA's Cantonese service.
This law is very broad and too general, and a lot of gray area that a lot of people, they still need to think about it, because this is totally against the civil law, the traditional civil law like in United States or in UK. And this law, the government claimed that it will safeguard the government's security and prevent the so-called black violence, which is a protest like what you see in the year of 2019. And the government also claimed that this law can prevent any color revolution and advocate the Hong Kong independence or any espionage activity. But a lot of people are worried because this law require everybody, to report any suspicious activity related with those so-called crimes. Even the religious cannot have exemption. Like, for example, I'm a Catholic or I'm a Protestant. If I need to go to my priest for the confession, and if the priest hears something possible, probably violate this law, they have obligation to report to the authorities. So the religious belief are also on stake in here. And also, there will be lots of gray area, like if you are the business, you want to set up a due diligence investigation in Hong Kong. It probably some of the data are so-called sensitive and related with the so-called state secrets, and you will not be able to retrieve it or write a report about that. And of course, it also affected the freedom of speech and freedom of press. The journalists, when they try to file the report, are they going to violate this law? Possible.
Now, it's not the first time that Hong Kong has tried to impose similar laws, similar restrictions. What's happened in the past?
Well, in the past, it's only used other criminal audience or criminal law to accuse you. And as you know, Hong Kong is the law legal system just follow the British and also similar to America. So there will be a lot of restriction that the evidence need to be very solid in order to file the charges against you. But now all these restrictions are totally gone. They are just following the mainland Chinese style. The police can detain you beyond 48 hours without give you any reason. So this is really concerned about for the personal safety in Hong Kong at this moment.
So this doesn't sound very much like the one country, two systems we've been told about before.
No, not anymore. That's scare people about, and that's worry. Although the government keeps a guarantee that business will be the same as usual, we need to wait and see how they practice. And besides, a lot of speculation that they are so hurried to pass this law. Are there any hidden agenda?
Now, how does this law and the so-called basic law of Hong Kong, which guarantees certain rights, how do these two things coexist together?
This is a good question, because right now in Hong Kong, they are practicing that national security law. It's already in doubt that how do they comply with the basic law, because there are a lot of contradiction between the national security law, which imposed like almost 3 years ago, and the currently existing basic law. And now you have this new regulation, where especially they said that they won't guarantee your personal freedom and probably detained by the police for more than 48 hours under the investigation. How can it comply with the freedom or the protection under the basic law? It's definitely in doubt.
Raymond Yam is the service chief of VOA's Cantonese service. Mr. Yam, thanks for being with us today. Thanks for your analysis.
Thank you very much.
Meanwhile, in other China news, again, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken at a press conference in the Philippines said that China's actions in the South China Sea had triggered a wider international reaction, and the United States was engaged in intense diplomacy to reaffirm international law.
These waterways are critical to the Philippines, to its security, to its economy, but they're also critical to the interests of the region, the United States, and the world.
The Philippines and China have in recent months exchanged sharp rebukes and protests over each other's actions in the South China Sea, a strategic waterway that carries through it trillions of dollars worth of global trade every year. For its part, Beijing says the United States had no right to interfere in maritime disputes between Manila and Beijing, and that China would take the necessary actions to defend its territory. Lin Jian is China's foreign ministry spokesperson.
The United States is not party to the South China Sea issue, and it has no right to interfere in the maritime issues between the two countries. Military cooperation between the United States and the Philippines should not harm China's sovereignty and maritime rights and interests in the South China Sea, let alone be used to prop up the Philippines' illegal position. China will continue to take necessary measures to firmly defend its territorial sovereignty and maritime rights and interests, and uphold peace and stability in the South China Sea.
Annual military exercises between the U.S. and Philippine forces have also widened lately to include joint air and sea patrols over the South China Sea and close to Taiwan, which China sees as provocations. And finally today, elsewhere in Asia, North Korean leader Kim Jong-un is again ratcheting up regional tension with so-called super-large rocket launchers. Reuters' Ryan Brooks explains.
North Korea's Kim Jong-un oversaw artillery drills involving what state media called super-large rocket launchers in the country's west. That's according to state news agency KCNA on Tuesday. The drills came after a two-month pause in missile tests from the north ended on Monday. That's also when South Korea and Japan reported Pyongyang fired short-range ballistic missiles into the sea. And it was the same day U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken visited Seoul for a conference on advancing democracy. It's not clear if the timing was intentional. However, state media said that Kim himself oversaw the Monday drills to assess the, quote, real war capabilities of 600-millimeter multiple rocket launchers to boost operator morale and readiness. State media said the drills involved simulating an air explosion of the rocket launcher shell, showcasing the unit's high mobility and accurate and strong striking power in a sudden combat mission. And state news agency KCNA said that drew praise from Kim. The South's defense minister on Monday warned that if North Korea launches a significant number of conventional missiles at the South, it would be considered an act of war and lead to strong retaliatory measures.
That's Reuters' Ryan Brooks reporting for us. And that's going to wrap up today's show. There's more VOA coverage 24 hours a day on our website, voanews.com, and across our social media platforms. On behalf of everyone here at VOA, thanks for listening. Until tomorrow, I'm Steve Karish.
For deeper dives and expert analysis, listen to VOA Podcasts. Issues in the News explores the biggest stories every weekend, while International Edition keeps you informed every weekday. Plus, with the 5-minute newscast at the top of every hour, you're always up to date.